Well, hi everyone, and welcome to Designers for Learning. This is our 11th webcast in the series. Today is Monday, November 18th, and I'm very happy and excited to be joined by my guest, Dr. Monica Tracy. She is faculty at Wayne State University, and fortunately for me, made her way to Chicago. She's moved here, about a year now? You almost at the year mark? Yay! And so I have been the beneficiary of that. So hopefully today we can pick her brain and get her to share with us all her wisdom in terms of how she sets up and establishes applied learning or service learning experiences for her students. So with that, Monica, is there anything in the introduction that I missed that's really important about, that we should know?
No, I think you've got it all. I think the best part about this is that I live in the city. I live downtown, and I commute back to Wayne State, so I'm very familiar with I-94. I commute back every couple of weeks and do everything else online like we're doing right now. So it's working out beautiful.
It's great. Oh, there's Jason. I'm looking also, and in case anyone is just listening to us, maybe you found the feed over at Google Hangout, which it could be. If you point your browser over to designersforlearning.org/live, that's where we also have a text chat. So I've embedded the video, and then we have a text chat running with other participants who are here. And I see Peggy George. Hi. And feel free to back channel all you wish. I can try to multitask and ask Monica questions as I see them, and we'll do the same if we have any questions for you. So should we just start in with it, Monica?
Absolutely. Fire away.
Fire away.
I have not seen these questions beforehand. I want everyone to know that. So
do you want to pull
on the spot, boy. Okay, go ahead.
Do you want to pull up your PowerPoint that you said you were going to prepare?
Yes, I have no PowerPoint. You told me not to prepare. This is all just everything's up here. All right, I'm ready.
All right. So as I said, what is the focus and purpose of our topic today is, however you want to call it, applied learning or service learning opportunities, which for those of you who are maybe unfamiliar with this topic, it's the idea of offering our students opportunities to work with real-life clients in the course of your the project that you may have designed within your class. And so Monica has worked with clients both in the for-profit world and as well as the nonprofit world. And so can you just give us an overview of maybe starting at the beginning, why did you originally do this? Because it is a lot of work as we're about to get into. So what do you see as the benefits and when and why did you start?
Okay. I don't want to be long-winded, and I don't see the chats. So if anybody gets to a point where they want to cut me off, would you please type it in and Jennifer will give me the hook and we'll go on to the next question. I think that it's important to know a little bit about where I came from, because that was the impetus for making the decision of using applied learning or service learning in the classroom. I graduated from college a long time ago, and I ended up getting a master's degree in education, in administration, and I got my first job in a training field in 1986. This was after I had worked for a few years in another field. But I did not have a degree in training. So in 1994, I thought, you know what, I really need to get a degree that kind of will help me do what I'm doing. So I kind of entered it backward. I was in the field already for a number of years, discovered instructional technology, discovered Wayne State's program, and went down to Wayne State and started in on a doctorate. So what happened was I was learning things in the classroom, right? But I was also practicing outside the classroom. And some of the, I don't want to use negative terms, but some of the structure and rigidity of what I was learning in the classroom in terms of how to did not fit in the real world. So I'm going to my real job during the day, and then I'm taking these classes at night, and I thought, I have to figure out a way so that both are used, because they're both useful. So fast forward to a number of years later, I ended up completing the program, and I got my first academic position at Oakland University, and I was working with undergraduate and graduate students. Now, the undergraduate students were pretty young. They were a pretty traditional group, so I wasn't really comfortable with putting them out there, and they really didn't have the skill set to be put out there in front of a client. But what I noticed with my advanced graduate students, my advanced master's students, were they, if they had not practiced in the field, before taking the program and that program was called Training and Development. If they had not practiced in the field, they couldn't really grasp everything they learned in the books. Mm-hmm. You just can't make that connection. So I took the Advanced Instructional Design class and I took it to the streets. And the very first time I did it was I found it was an evening class and it was a face-to-face class, which I know is a little different from what many are doing now and certainly what we are doing now. But I found a manufacturing company that was open at night. They made pizza. And they agreed to let my class come in. Now, here's a couple of pointers that I learned right off. I took the class and divided them in teams of three or four, no more than four designers in a team. That was important. Every design problem had to be vetted through me as the professor. In other words, I sat with the president, the CEO, and the head of HR and said to them, what are your four biggest challenges right now? Some of the challenges were too big for 15 weeks. So we X those out, and then I had to bring them down to tasks or projects that could be done within that time frame.
Okay, so just like to step back for those that are just getting into this and maybe interested in doing it. So from what you're saying, you didn't just let your students loose. You didn't just say, here's the phone number for a contact.
No.
So, and we've heard this pretty much from everybody who's been on the first 10 sessions, that the upfront work you need to do would be involved in setting the scope of the project. So, and then kind of tying it back to for those that may be familiar with performance consulting and HPT, so you're basically getting, that's your approach, right? You're asking them specific things that were addressing the performance issues within their organization. Is that a fair
way to summarize? Asking them specific performance issues, and they were even having a difficult time articulating them because they were not used to such terminology. Mm-hmm. So I took a tour of the plant. I met with the HR director. I met with the head of the plant, the plant production. I did a lot of vetting way before the class started. Okay. We ended up settling on four projects. Then what was key was each one of those projects had a contact person, the project lead person from the client side.
Okay.
So I could not just leave it with, this is the company we're in, and here's the four teams, and here's the four projects, okay, go.
Okay.
I think the most critical thing in any service learning or applied learning successful situation is communication. Communication with the client and the lead, who happened to be me, communication with the team members and me as the instructor, and communication with the team members and the client. Mm-hmm. And I had to set that entire process up before the class started.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm shared with Monica. I'm reading a book that was put out by the folks at Taproot Foundation, and if you've never followed any of their work, it's really awesome. They do not necessarily service learning, but they do pro bono work. They have professionals coming in to work with nonprofits, and so it's taprootfoundation.org, and they have a book, a pro bono by design, or something like that, is the title of the book, and I'll put it in the chat when I'm done talking. But when I was meeting with Monica, I said, well, this whole engagement process, they've laid out quite well in the book, and they refer on the client side of things, they talk about that role as the engagement manager. So that would be the person that they would say has to be committed on the client side, mm-hmm. to answer questions, to be there for updates on how the project is going, those types of things. Because without that person as a gatekeeper within the organization, you'll hit too many dead ends. You can't just keep working with the point of contact that you originally met with.
And my point of contact was the CEO of the company.
Yeah.
That the CEO of the company did nothing with any of these projects.
Right.
Okay, the company was about 150 employees. It wasn't real small. They ran three shifts, which was great for us. But the CEO was certainly not going to be dealing with our group. The CEO is very busy trying to make money and do other things. So although he was our original point of contact, that ended. We also spent the time, and I've done this ever since, where we put together a contract, a written contract. And basically it's an agreement between, so that the client points of contact people understand what their jobs are, what their role is, and the students understand what their role is. Everybody's very excited in the beginning. Mm-hmm. People, the students are like thrilled. Everybody's excited and they want to get in there and they want to solve all the problems. But when you get down to it, what do we know about design? It's very messy and it takes a lot of iterations and it's a constant problem solution process. So our you know, there's times, especially about week 7 when the other classes are getting in the way and things aren't going real well and there's been problems. So I needed to have signed contracts on both ends. And that was very valuable. And it helped the client point of contact people really understand what their jobs were. Mm-hmm. And part of the contract included things like you will make yourself available. I agree to make myself available once a week via email or phone to communicate for 30 to 60 minutes with my design team. Mm-hmm. Those were the kinds of things. Most of the client point of the point person did a lot more. They got very excited because they saw their jobs were going to be easier. So we never really had a problem with the client side, them not being engaged. But you got to find the right people, and that's now a critical piece.
In our earlier webcast, I was speaking with Trey Martindale about what they use as a contract. I also, in the class, I used a contract, or I attempted to, and I got a lot of pushback from both the students as well as their nonprofits. And they, for whatever reason, the word contract freaked everybody out. And so we switched to using a memorandum of understanding, and that seemed to be a little bit easier.
We called it a memorandum of understanding. We've also, what else have we called it? We've called it a number of things. A service agreement.
Okay.
We've used that term as well. I mean, those are semantics.
Yeah.
You know your client, know your class, and I don't get pushback much from students about things like that, but I can understand, you know your class, know your client.
Yeah, and Peggy's asking in the chat, are these legally binding? And I think that was the issue. The clients were like, what am I signing? Am I suddenly going to get a bill for some, you know, are they?
I see. They're not legally binding. But the thing that's so important, and that was a great question, was it Peggy who asked that question?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
It's a great question. The thing that's so important is that I think it is the way we approach it. It is the value we give this. I go in to this believing I'm giving my students an opportunity. Mm-hmm. It's not a job. It's not an assignment. It's an opportunity. The client is coming into it believing they are also getting an opportunity, which is why I focus so much on nonprofits now. They never could afford to have the services or the products designed that we give them. So in that spirit of optimism and opportunity that both sides enter in, I've never had in all of the years. A situation where a client has backed out or not lived up to their end of the bargain ever. And I've done this every semester for a number of years. Because it's the way that you approach it, and it's the way that you have it set up so that we know that there's going to be constraints. Design is all about constraints. But you don't want to have constraints in your process. You want your process to be as ironclad as possible to make life easy for everyone.
And so going back to and I interrupted you as you're going through your process to set it up, you have the groups, and you started to describe how you chunk these projects to something that's manageable within a 16-week, or most semesters about 15, 16 weeks, depending on the program. And so what's involved in that? Like, how hard is it to take these grand ideas, as you're saying, you're asking them pretty broad questions about performance, and then trying to tailor it to a small, discrete chunk of an issue that you can tackle?
One of the best questions I've asked, and I've asked this all the years that I've been doing consulting work, and depending on how much time we have to deliver whatever or do whatever intervention they want, I will ask them, what two things do you want your people to be able to do or know when they walk out? Or what three things? It is very easy for a client to be able to say, oh, okay, I want them to be able to do this, this, and this. That is how I end up coming up with scope of projects.
Okay.
And that way it makes it manageable.
And
am
so,
I getting a question?
Yeah, actually, yeah, okay. Perfect. And so Jason's asking a question. So within the time frame of a 15-week semester, and this is what I ran to, Jason, he said, are you really able to get much beyond the analysis phase, or as you would talk, you know, phrase it, discovery, which we'll talk about in a moment, which is really interesting. I love talking to Monica about the whole design process and how designers work, but I call it analysis. She calls it pushes back with discovery. But how much can you realistically get done?
Okay, the first week I teach the students about design thinking. You know what? Can you all see me? Because it just says my network connection is experiencing difficulties. Check your connectivity.
Yep, I can see you, but
okay,
we were getting a tad bit of lag, but
okay,
I can see you.
Right. Go ahead. Okay, the first week I make the students introduce themselves, their experiences. I ask them crazy questions, like if you could put your name on a bumper sticker. If you could describe yourself on a bumper sticker, what would it say? I'm trying to get to know my students as best I can because I don't normally have them before this class. I see where I put them on the spot with a lot of questions, and so I can get to know them as best as I can. The second week, I create the teams. And I create the teams with a very strong purpose, sense of purpose. I believe that I can assemble a team made up of individuals who can complement one another and who can work with one another, not personally. I don't care about personal. I'm looking at professional attributes. And it's not just about experience. There's many other things that I'm looking for, innovation, creativity, ability to see things through, seeing the being able to look at and handle the minutia. We need all those different types of people on a design team. So I assemble the teams. Third week, they meet with the client. We go right out to site, and they visit the site. They sit down with their point of contact person. Every team had one human being in that team who was the contact person with the client point of contact. So there was only one person contacting one person, and I was copied on all emails. Any kind of communications I was always copied on. So by week three, they've already read about the company, had all the background. I have all the background materials given to each team. I've got all of that ahead of time. They've met with the client. We're already designing. We already start designing. And then it becomes a matter of we start having deliverables, which those deliverables are the ways of they're all prototypes in the beginning. But they're things so that the client can react to, so that I can gauge the team in terms of how far they're getting done. I don't buy into you do an extensive needs assessment that's going to take you 12 weeks. That is not the way we do design in the real world. The way we do design in the real world is we identify a problem, we start thinking about the solution, we go back and look at the problem again, think about the solution. It's a constant problem-solution interchange that is iterative. So by the last week, I'm fast-forwarding, but by the last week, week 15, we do our pilot to the client, which includes all instructor materials, all participant materials, any kind of supporting materials. We do a presentation to the client where we actually deliver the course, the instruction. They usually will bring in a pilot group. We do collect pilot data from that. But it's interesting because what we have done when the class was in class, starting about week six, we were piloting our prototypes.
Wow. So you are a taskmaster.
Yeah, we were prototypes because the students would come in, they would pilot, they'd get feedback from all the other students who were also working with the same client. You got to remember, you have four different projects, but it's the same umbrella client. So what one pilot group was delivering, another pilot group was saying, oh my gosh, I learned this with our topic, but it kind of overlaps with this, which was helping everybody. Plus, they were becoming better designers. They were creating ideas while listening to others. They were getting feedback from their peers and myself. So we would pilot from week 6 till about week 13. All the while, we're continuing to design and develop. Week 13 was pretty much getting those final products done. So was it Jason who asked how we did it?
Yeah, and how far you got.
That's the Reader's Digest version of how we do it.
So it sounds like I have a lot to learn. I changed my expectations for how much we can get done in 15 weeks, because I was pretty satisfied that we got to a recommendation of anything stage. So because this was a component of a consulting skills class, and so I did it a little differently for those. I think I mentioned it in a prior webcast, but just to recap how I handled that one, it was all a virtual class online with a few meetings. A few hours of each week meeting online using Adobe Connect, and so I did not take on the role of finding the client. And so it took us several weeks for me to help the students find their clients, and so that pushed us out to like week 5 or 6 before everybody had their clients assembled, which is another way to do it, because again, this was a consulting skills class, so I was trying to get them an opportunity to practice what you're talking about, the scale to scale and scope a project, find a client, talk about your skills, compare it to their needs, and those types of things, which is cool to do as well. But inherently then you're going to be behind the eight ball in terms of how far you're going to be able to take the project. And then we do have some questions. Peggy was asking in terms of managing the project. That's just a lot of details for you as the faculty to try to keep. And I equate it to like herding cats, is when you've got all these different projects going. Do you do that yourself, or in those four teams, do you have one of the students act as kind of the account manager on the whole deal?
It's a great question, Peggy. And there's a number of things that we did, and I had things in the syllabus that were very specific. I have things that state this is how you're going to work together as a team, because we don't have time for team dysfunction. There's no time. So this is how you're going to work as a team. Here's an example. I would not have one individual team member come to me at any point to complain about other team members. I know this sounds silly, but if there were issues going on in the team worked it out amongst each other. If they could not, the entire team came to me. That way, we could solve issues, solve problems, and get back on task. Mm-hmm. Having something so simple as that, it was incredible how well these teams rose to the challenge and managed themselves. Yes, it's a lot of work managing the teams. What I did was I had, once again, that team kind of a leader, the point of contact. They constantly were communicating with me and the client point of contact. Okay. So that communication would go on daily. Now, what that was for me, that was four email threads a day. Sometimes many exchanges, but only four a day. So if you think about a class of 20 and I'm getting four, it really isn't that much when you are prepared and when you know what's going on. If I was very, very organized up front. Then when we had the benefit of being all in class together before I was doing this online, everybody was in the room, and I was giving feedback to everybody, and they were all learning from each other, so my workload decreased. What I did do, though, was I had a lot of deliverables. We did personas where they had to really describe their client. I mean, describe their client. This was not your typical learner analysis. This was, what are the learner's hopes? What are their dreams? Where do they come from? Why do they work there? We were dealing with all types of questions that were much deeper than age, education, demographics. That's all well and good to start, but in order to really, really design for your learner, we had to go very deep, so they had to do their persona discoveries, including pictures. They had to give those to me. Then we went into the define stage, where we were really trying to define the outcome. What is this going to look like? That was when I had them start giving me sketches already. I wanted storyboards. I wanted descriptions, deep descriptions of their end product. It changed drastically, but it had to be something that I could react to and that the other team members could react to. All right, do you have another question?
I do. And Jason, I'm going to this is a perfect opportunity, I think, to segue and talk specifically about instructional design. So I apologize to anyone who's listening who's not an instructional designer or doesn't care about this topic, because we're going to get pretty inside baseball here in instructional design in a moment. But Jason's asking the question, or making a statement, really, that it's really an issue. It's going to be different per course depending on what your goals are. And just getting on my soapbox a moment, I've peeked into this service learning world a little bit, and it appears that is really maybe a critique that I could make in general of some of the projects I see, that it's more geared toward service to the organization in terms of acting like a volunteer, so helping them do whatever it is that they typically have volunteers or need to do. And what we're talking about is really different. It's taking our skills and knowledge as professionals in our field of instructional design, right, and working with them on performance projects. And so, and then taking it to that next level, it's a specific class we're teaching. And so then you need to tailor the objectives you have for your class to the project. So it makes sense that the project they're working on actually has something to do with the class.
And the beauty of it is that for most of our students who have not had experience in the field, they use this end product in their portfolio. They show this to potential employers down the road. We know that to develop as a designer, to develop your designer identity, you have to have experiences. You have to have precedents. You can't just read about it. You can't even do just case studies about it. You have to get in and do it. And that is, it's such a gift for the student, and it's such a gift for the nonprofit. Now, this last time, we've started doing online classes. Our courses are now online. And there have been a few changes that have had to happen because of that, most of it embracing the technology, as you've mentioned. But I still maintain the tasks that I do. We still end up with end products. Not all of them, and I make the decision, not all of them will be presented to the client. Because if they are not ready to be presented to the client by the end of the semester, I'm certainly not going to waste the client's time or hurt our reputation by letting them see mediocre work. Mm-hmm. And we have had that happen, not often, but it has happened where they weren't ready.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, one thing I do is, I don't want to say a disclaimer to the client, but more of a setting expectations. I purposely use the word service learning, and I get a lot of pushback from people that it's kind of a loaded term. As I was just saying, sometimes people equate service learning to be a volunteer or whatever it might be, and there's just kind of some baggage, unfortunately, it's been around for so long, so people have different perceptions. But I like the phrase service learning because it's a two-way street. We're offering you a service, but at the same time, we're learning. And so, as you're saying, your students are doing the best they can in most cases to offer something great, but it is a messy process. Learning is always messy, and even as well as you manage it, as you said, you hit roadblocks in the semester, and maybe at the end it's not exactly what you were hoping you'd deliver, but I think if you set that expectation at the beginning that the students are learning, this is a learning experience for them, and they're going to do their best, that again, it's this two-way street, I think it helps to manage those expectations when you do kind of hit those bumps in the road. Where
the other thing that I think it's important to know for faculty is I would never put an introduction class in this situation.
Yes, that's a really
good point. Never put a course, this is the capstone course for a master's program, and we have a lot of doctoral students in it as well. So they need that foundation. They need all of those things behind them, so I am not busy trying to catch them up while they're working with the client. I'm actually helping them make the connections from what they know in their head and what they feel in their gut and what the client needs, and making those connections so that we end up with a product at the end. So it's very important that we don't take this on and put our students in front of clients until they are really ready, right, in terms of where they are in the program.
No, I couldn't agree more. It's tough on everybody at that point.
Right. It's not good for our field.
No.
So are there other questions?
There is. So I think this is a great – how about if we take a few minutes to talk about Barb's asking a question about how then you work now that it's more of a virtual environment in terms of the students finding the clients or working with clients. So let's talk about that for a little bit, moving this whole process virtual. And then let's talk about the design process, because this is one of my favorite things to do over lunch with Monica. And I do tease her. I say that she's a touchy-feely designer. So I do give her a hard time, but I could not be more interested in the process she actually takes As she started to describe, from the moment she meets the client until the design process is well underway and all the way through until the deliverable. It's just, it's not textbook, it's real life, and I think it's awesome, and I do want to give her plenty of time to do that. But let's just, before we get into that, let's just take a couple minutes and talk about how your process has changed now that you are moving into an online and virtual classes. Yeah.
Okay. Once again, and this might be a control thing on my part, but it yields the best results, I always find the client. So what I did, it was an interesting experience this last class, which we're writing about it now. Actually, there's been an article that's already been accepted in the Journal of Applied, the International Journal of Designs for Learning. It's not published yet, but it's been accepted. So you can go to that in the next several months, and it'll be in that journal. But what we did was we found a client who actually was a psychotherapist and wanted to develop a 6-week parenting seminar all online. So what I did is I came in with some expert designers and before the class, and I worked with the client to flesh out what the 6-week program would look like, how he envisioned it, what he wanted it to be. I kind of came up with the initial design, First week, 6th week, we're going to be face-to-face. The other 4 weeks, we're going to be all online. We kind of had an idea we had a definite, clear idea of the content, that kind of thing. Then I brought in my class, and I followed the exact same process. We had 4 groups. Everyone took a week. They got their basic content. The difference with this was because we were online, and it was kind of a difficult thing, the students had a harder time interacting with other teams. They didn't have a difficult time interacting with each other or with me. And I gave the students as an extra support a design expert. So every team had 4 students, a PhD design expert, who was not just a PhD student, but was an expert in instructional design, and myself. Wow. And I gave them that extra person because we were online. And I knew that there was going to be gaps from not being able to be in that room, going through prototypes, pilot testing, all those weeks. That helped, having the design experts for each team. 2 of the teams had a really, really difficult time. But the interesting thing is all 4 teams, even though they all had their content, which had overlaps, but I gave them enough outline in terms of what had to be included in their session, they all came up with interesting designs. So we presented all 4 to the client. And the client picked the one he liked best.
Okay.
Then he picked the layout of the one he liked best. And then we just took the other weeks and we plugged it all in to that layout, and it was this beautiful cohesive program.
Okay, so you went from 4, the client picked the one they liked, and then everybody continued working on the chosen design? Is that?
No, it was after the 15 weeks.
Okay.
The designers and myself, we actually had 2 students who were so into the project, they continued on and they made it their master's project.
Okay.
And they made it all identical.
And that was a question in the chat is, given the constraints of 15 weeks, are there ways you can figure out to extend it? And it sounds like that's exactly what you did.
Yeah, absolutely.
You identified a couple students who needed the extra time and whatever.
Because they wanted to do this as their master's project. They were very engaged in it. So they asked if they could continue on, and they ended up flushing it all out till all the entire seminar was completed, and it ended up being their master's project.
That's awesome. And we have a couple last questions kind of to this point. The Barb's mentioning the skills of working with an SME and the content experts. And so is that also, you're feeling that even in the virtual environment, they're getting sufficient ability to do that, you think?
I think that we had a hard time. It's a great question, Barb. It was harder in the virtual environment. What we ended up doing was the teams, they decided, and you have to remember, our client was a psychotherapist. What do psychotherapists do? They talk one-on-one with a person. Mm-hmm. They're not doing it virtually, so you have to really think about your client. Our psychotherapist wanted to meet with the students, so there were some students who were geographically near him, and they could do that, some of the teams. Other teams would call him on the phone. He preferred the phone to this type of environment. We had to adhere to what the client was comfortable with. And so they would put a phone in the middle of the room, and they would talk with him on the phone with me as well. So there were a little bit of constraints based just because we were in a virtual environment in terms of really dealing with the client and fleshing things out as quickly as we could have if we were all in the same room.
But then again, this is where the world's going to.
And that's so right, and we have to learn to adjust.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to happen in the real world. All right, so now let's turn the corner.
Are we ready? Are there no other questions on the service learning or
I'll keep an eye out, and please feel to pepper them in the chat room as we go. But so let's hear about instructional design according to the world according to Monica.
The design according to Monica. This is not just according to me, and this is the thing that's really interesting for any of you who are really interested in looking at design. There is the design school at Stanford University, and this actually comes from them. So please make sure to just Google D School Stanford University and you will get it. And design there, they look at design as its own discipline. They look at design as its own field of study. They look at design as it's interdisciplinary. The way I approach design is this, and it could be because I've been a designer since 1986, which is a long time. I'm a designer first. I happen to design instruction. So if I was a designer who happened to design cars, I would still be a designer first. So given that, if you look at yourself as a designer first, and this is how I teach my students, you are a designer first, but you happen to design, your product is instruction, or for some non-instructional solutions, which I've done as well. But that's what we are first as designers. So if we look at ourselves as that, and we look at design as a space that we are in, okay? And when I go into my design space, and I'll give you an example, I'm working now on a very difficult 5-year project. Jennifer, you know a little bit about it.
Yep.
I'm working with the School of Medicine, radio-oncology. Radio-oncology, MD, PhDs, will be teaching and coming to a week-long seminar on the most cutting-edge therapies in cancer treatments. Okay. Do I know anything about radio-oncology? No. Nothing. I mean, what little I know is very little. Okay. But I'm a designer. So I know, and my design team knows, and believe me, they're struggling because the content is so difficult. We're having all sorts of constraints, even just talking to the SMEs, trying to get them to understand the questions we're trying to ask because they're way up here and we're here trying to design. But our product, I can see our product in our head. I can see, I've been designing this product in my mind for the last 2 months. Now, you know, according to all of the standard design models we follow, I shouldn't be seeing our product. I should still be in the needs assessment phase. But that's not how we design. Oftentimes when you get a project, don't you all think as designers, oh, I think it should be this, or oh, it should look like this, right up front. You're already solving it. To stop that process is to stop innovation, and I just don't believe in that. I think it should look like this will change. It will alter throughout the process. But you must document that, draw it, write it, get it down somewhere, talk about it with people. My poor husband is like, please stop talking to me about this stupid class. I keep talking to him about this course. I think I'm going to do this. I think I'm going to do an interview the expert where I'm just going to have an expert standing there and I'm just going to do a YouTube video for a minute where I give them one question. He's like, would you please, I'm designing this thing in my head.
So here's a question, and not to play devil's advocate, but I just know from experience that happened to me. Once you start, when you have the idea before you, and you're about to talk then about, you know, the kind of the discovery piece of it, before you've done that piece, how easy is it to let go of your idea when you're kind of seeing things that aren't necessarily making sense with what your solution is? Is that kind of a hard process for some people to let go of these initial ideas?
It's a great question because that is one of the key components of developing your identity, taking your ego out, letting it go for the good of your end product. I can give you another example. I was working with pediatrics. This was 2 years ago. Pediatrics, trying to deal with children with diabetes, childhood diabetes. And they wanted me to design something to help their patients, childhood diabetes. This is what I came up with. 3 weeks took me in my head. I came up with an app that they would be able to use on their smartphone. It would be a game. These are kids, remember, right? It would be a game. There would be certain levels that they could get to. The way they got to those levels was by putting in their insulin numbers. So they had to do certain things in order to get to these levels. They would compete with each other. I had this whole thing worked out, right? I get there. I'm thrilled. I have storyboards. I'm going through with the pediatricians. I'm laying it all out. What did they say to me?
They hated it. I don't know.
They didn't hate it. You know what they said? No, this is too out there. This is not our patients won't do this. We can't count on our parents to make sure they do it. We don't know if they're going to have smartphones, which I knew all of this was to be bunk, but whatever. And I had to say, okay, all right. They didn't want to take that leap. And they led me to believe they did. 3 weeks in, they didn't. Believe me, I cried when I scrapped that one, but I scrapped it. We started over again. So I guess we have to know, and while I was creating that one, others were flowing. So I was still, flip charting other ideas that were options. That's part of our process.
Well, and then also there are elements that I'm sure you kept, right, in your final.
Oh, absolutely.
So
absolutely.
It's not
the game
totally
element stayed. I mean, the game element stayed. They loved the game element. There were a number of elements that did stay. They liked the way I was asking the patient to input their insulin. There were many things that stayed. But there were also things that were gone. They didn't like the app idea. Okay, fine, we'll do it another way. I liked it because you could collect all your data. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me it made sense, but whatever. I guess what I'm trying to say is that those, you continue to flush those, and you don't overlook the other things that are critical. Coming up with, and this is once again from Stanford, these words, I'm going to give you the buzzwords. Okay, the first one is that we discover, and that's where we're really looking at our personas and the environment, the learning environment, and the performance environment, and the individuals that are the learners. And I look at the clients. All that happens during that discover phase, and what are we looking to do? Then we get into our define, and that's where we start to see that end product. All of this is happening at once, however, often. Then we get into our ideate, and we're looking at the context, and then we start developing prototypes. And I think that we need to develop prototypes quickly. They don't have to be expensive. It can be a drawing on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. But we have to give our clients something to react to and our design team something to react to, because that's where the innovation continues to go. And then we go into testing. And these are these overarching terms. And if you think about it, they're not very different from some of the terms that we use. I mean, there are different words, but it's the process is still the same. I think that the difference with how I teach my designers is this. You're a designer first. I won't even introduce them to instructional design until week 8 of their intro course. They have to be a design. I teach them about being a designer and design first. And the other thing is I really stay away from those step-by-step models, because then we have to unlearn them. I never used a step-by-step model in all my years of practice.
And it's kind of like I was saying, too, with service learning. Certain things, especially in our profession, that we've been doing similar things, teaching things, it has mm-hmm. a lot of baggage. So as an example, for one of our lunchtime conversations with Monica, I said I really struggled in this last class I'm teaching, when we kind of did go a bit more step-by-step than maybe I would do in the future, but we had a phase where we talked about the learner, and I very much called it learner analysis. And so, as Monica said, I got into a lot of I got a lot of stuff back, age, mm-hmm. demographic stuff. And then let's contrast that to what your idea of personas, which I think is awesome. And maybe you could use your example of what you're doing within within the grant to talk about how you're literally naming your
yes.
personas.
This is the difference. What do we really want to know about our learner? Do we really care how old they are? And we used to. Because we used to look at things like maybe their age would indicate their technology. I have a 90-year-old mother who's on Gmail and Skype and Googles and everything. So I can't really use that. I mean, maybe she's an outlier, but I can't really use that so much. If you're in the work environment, which is where most of our clients are, they have to have some kind of technology savvy. Very rarely are we finding that now anymore. So what we did, I'll give you the example since you asked for it, because we had a blast with it. Our design team is made up of four designers and myself, and then I have two subject matter experts who are, one's a radio oncologist in biology, another is a radio oncologist in physics. And we sit together and we do these design sessions. So the first session, my designers wanted to go the route of analysis. And I said, wait a minute. Tell us about who's going to be coming to this class. So our SME said, well, we're going to get some people who are going to be in research. Research only. I said, so what you're telling me is they have MDs, PhDs, but they only want to do research in a lab. And he says, yes. And I said, all right, this is Bob. Bob got an MD, PhD. Bob could be a doctor making a ton of money in private practice in radio oncology. Bob opted out. What do we know about Bob knowing that? The designers started looking at Bob completely differently. What motivated Bob? The research, the ahas. What do we have to include in our instruction? Those aha moments. We've got to do some problems, real serious problems for Bob to solve, right? Mm-hmm. So we ended up with three different personas because of our SME saying, you're going to get others who are going to be teaching, MD, PhDs, but they've chosen to go into to become professors at universities. Okay, I said, this is Janice. What does Janice tell us? She, too, could be in private practice. She opted out. She's not making as much money as she would make if she was a private practitioner as a physician. So let's talk about her. What motivates her? She does research, but she really prefers to teach. She wants to teach others. Let's talk about her persona. What do we have to do for her? We have to give her opportunities to teach others. So we're designing sessions within these sessions where she can talk about others. In with that persona could talk about their cutting edge ideas, their cutting edge discoveries. We have a whole different person now. We have Janice, we have Bob. Let's talk about the third one, and that's the private practitioner. The motivations for the private practitioner, Sue, are going to be very different than the motivations for the private for the research staff person, Bob. We talked about Bob chooses to be in a lab. He's not a big collaborator. How is that going to affect our design? Do you see the difference when you start to name them?
Exactly. And so I totally tease Monica at lunch. As soon as she says the word discovery, I purposely, I know it irritates her. I say, oh, you mean analysis? Because I know she doesn't really exclusively mean analysis. So I am listening to you, but I do kind of like to push your buttons on your discovery. But
it's okay. You're not the first. I mean, I'm bucking the system completely. I'm doing this. There's a lot of us out there.
I must have some buy-in because I asked you to come and talk about it.
Right.
So,
right.
No, it's more than that, though, because I think what you're hitting on, a learner analysis, you're not getting into motivations, and there's no way you can come up with a persona for every potential learner you may have. But it helps you as a designer think about how will the learner be using the materials, the subject matter, the skills, whatever it is your topic is, when they walk out the door. And so it helps you think about
how will they be hearing it and engaging in it while they're in the room.
Exactly.
In the instruction, because if they don't get it there, if they turn you off, forget it. You failed.
Exactly.
No matter how good your instruction is. And then what will they be doing with it when they leave? What do they want when they walk out the door?
And to me, those things aren't, you don't, I mean, I'm sure if you're a very seasoned designer and you have your analysis phase, you're probably doing very much what
right.
you're just, but it, I think your point, and it's very well taken, is when you're teaching a designer this is kind of the process that I think is missing when they just do a straight analysis, because then once you get the pushback of what you get is all demographics.
Absolutely.
and
you're not getting you're not getting to know the person. I also think the more connection you have with your learner, the more, I mean, we use the names now. They are our names in this big, huge project we have. We become more immersed in it. We want Bob to succeed.
Right.
We want Bob to be able to go back to his lab and be able to do everything he wants to do because of our week with us.
Right.
We feel very strongly about Bob. We haven't met Bob, but we know Bob. And those are the kinds of things. Do you have questions? I mean, we really have to be going over time, but are there any other questions?
We've got about 10 minutes left.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm kind of keeping an eye on it. No, I'm keeping an eye on the questions. Okay. And so, and I suppose that's, as you're saying, a lot of what you're doing is pushing stuff out, thinking about it, reiterating, trying again. And so I'm sure so pretty soon, if it sounds like Bob's really not what you thought Bob was, those things would be adjusted and tweaked. And I think, and not to steal your thunder, but the class I'm teaching this semester was the whole iterative process of design. You just have to get comfortable with messy, and that while you can't show all your cards to your client, or you will look disorganized and messy, and so what you show them will need to be tidied up to some degree. They can't necessarily see the.
I did a design panel at AECT in 2008, and David Jonathan was on the panel along with a number of other heavy hitters, and I moderated it. And the one thing David Jonathan said was, "Design is all about constraints." And I thought to myself, I know that because I've designed for years, and I know it's about uncertainty, but if a designer can feel comfortable in their skin to deal with constraints and uncertainty, to have the innovation to look at the end product, and to be able to make adjustments constantly along the way, they will be successful. Mm-hmm. Whether they're designing instruction or whether they're designing furniture, they will be successful.
Mm-hmm. And and being comfortable with the constraints, and then
the constraints, the uncertainty,
and
constant readjustment,
roll with the punches. Yeah,
yes, that's exactly right. And when we teach our students, do this box first, and then that box will lead to this box, we're taking all that away from them, and we're also telling them that'll work. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, it doesn't work.
Or
more upsetting to the student.
Or thinking we have any way, a crystal ball, to know what those constraints are at the outset. As you said, you thought you were on the completely right path with your mobile app, and then all of a sudden the constraint of, no, we can't do that mobile app comes way
right
in the process.
They just didn't want it. So we took other things, and you're going to be having constraints. We have design constraints on this big project daily. And we will, and we're just, it's constantly dealing with them and moving forward, a lot of collaboration, egos at the door, and it's working. So, but I do believe that you need to start with gaining some of that small experiences that service learning can give you. You need to start by having those.
And that, what a perfect little bow we can put on our package here, tying it back to service learning.
Just trying to help you out,
Jennifer. Thanks so much. You teed it up for me. No, exactly that. And as you're saying, hypothetical cases, you cannot do everything you've just described.
You start with those. In my very first introduction class, we do case studies. That's how I start. And then I advance them to service learning, and then we get into the big stuff.
Into the big stuff. And
right.
I do apologize. Barb reminded me, she did have a question. You had mentioned before you get into the instructional design piece, you have the students spend the time about the design thinking. So could you...
I just lost your audio.
...to use for that section of the course.
I'm sorry. What books do I use? Is that what you asked?
Yeah.
You cut out for a minute.
Oh, sorry about
what
that.
What readings? That's okay.
There's
a number of resources that I use. The first thing that I recommend for anybody, and I have now individuals in my world who are not instructional designers who read this book, it's Design Thinking by Nigel Cross. Very small book. It is the book that I have my students read the first 7 weeks of the course. They also do extensive journal writing, and I respond to those. On questions about, I'm beginning, there's actually a manuscript that's submitted right now. Hopefully it'll be accepted, and you'll be able to read about that process of reflection that I incorporate, because I teach my students all online now. I also give them different articles to read on design outside of our field, and there are also videos that they watch. CBS Sunday Morning a couple years ago did a whole hour and a half on design. If you Google CBS This Morning, you'll be able to, hopefully they'll still have those links up. If not, I can provide them. And they talked about jewelry design. They talked about OXO. OXO, I'm sure most of you have kitchen products in your kitchen that are OXO kitchen products. They talked about how those designers created those products. I have my students watching all of those videos before I say the word instructional design. So they begin to understand they are designers first. Their product is not measuring cups like OXO's is. Their product is instruction or something to help learners learn or individuals perform better on their jobs. And then we get into the instructional design. Does that help?
Absolutely.
Does that answer a question?
Yep, and I am as fast as I can typing, Googling. So I put in the two. Someone asked, I think it was Peggy was asking about links to the Jonathan books, and I think these are the ones you and I have talked about. You have before the Learning to Solve Problems from Jonathan,
yes.
Right?
Jonathan's problem solving approach is phenomenal. I still use that with my doctoral students. Mm-hmm.
And that's awesome. And then I also put in the link to Design Thinking, and I think it's the same one. Poor Monica told me to buy this book. I did download it to my Kindle. I have not yet read it. I have to. I cannot tell you why.
And the other thing that people should go to is the International Journal of Designs for Learning, Volume 1, Number 1. I did a multimedia case study on design on a large project I did in Dubai. And it's all multimedia. So they can go. You can go in and look at any one part of it. There's interviews. There's products you can look at. You'll be able to see our process. I have my students, my Introduction to ID students, watch that video and answer extensive questions on that case. Because what it is it's their first, rather than reading a case, they get to see we have an interview with the subject matter experts. We have an interview with the cultural experts. We have interviews with the designers. We show how the graphics designers played a huge role in it. And it's a great way for them to see an actual case of design and all the constraints we had, which were numerous, but they don't have to read it. Because when you read it, you only get it from one perspective. When you actually see it, and you don't have that background, those precedents, those experience, it helps you. So that's a great case for individuals to give to intro students to download and to read and answer questions about.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Oh, I'm hearing the...
Yeah, it's 1 o'clock. It's time to go.
Turning into a pumpkin. Well, thank you so much. You definitely did. And just to let everyone know, our next webcast is already set for December 4th, and the topic is going to be designing for GED preparation. And so it's really a cool panel that I'm going to have on. It just started out as one email. It's now bridged out to a whole bunch of cool people that I've never met, so that will be an interesting conversation. And again, hopefully tying into this whole idea of service learning, because I think there would be a lot of opportunity for faculty or students to tackle some of these GED preparations, so teaching to an adult audience, some of the things, skills and knowledge that we typically think of being taught in maybe third, fourth, fifth grade, you need to now think about how these things are going to translate to an older audience. And so the folks that are going to be on the next webcast are actively working on this. And so it'll be kind of a cool panel just to hear the state of that progress and maybe, again, ways you could enter and help out some of the projects that are underway. So thank you so much, Monica. Yay,
you're welcome. Thank you for having me. I'm so glad. I was really glad to be here.
Oh, and then one last question. It looks like Peggy's asking us for a link to the can you access the journal without a subscription? I'm not sure.
Yes, absolutely. You can. Okay. It's free. Free access.
Okay.
But you want to make sure to go back, Volume 1, Number 1. It was the very first issue. And you scroll down the page, and you'll see the multimedia articles. And it was, I can't remember the name. I'm the first author on it, Designing for a Cross-Cultural Instruction or something like that. And it's a really interesting case to watch, really interesting case. Even though I lived it, I mean, it's still an interesting case to watch.
And it looks like... Barb, thank you. We've got so many helpers, so many quick little Googlers. So Barb put the link into...
Fabulous.
It's great. I barely have to say it. And so thanks to everybody. And there's also a last question. Are the previous 10 webcasts on file? They are, and I'll put the link in. So if you go to designersforlearning.org/webcast, you'll see the prior 10 webcasts in this series. And Monica's will be there as number 11 shortly.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.